COINTELPRO and serving the New World Order agenda. That's right. We are CIA paid disinformants, and we are here to convince you that you can stop the New World Order and bring about a revolution of freedom in the minds of men, much like the Founding Fathers did. Just remember, this entire show is a farce, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. Good morning, Will.
Morning, Vinnie. CIA. CIA. Vinnie CIA Eastwood.
Well, I could pick what intelligence agency, really. I mean, but the CIA, you know, just the long, illustrious history. I mean, they're obviously the employer for me. Mossad, on the other hand, I'm not sure if I approve the whole killing Palestinian children and stuff like that. I think I'd just rather run copious amounts of drugs and arms trade in the South America.
New Zealand intelligence agencies don't have the ring to them, eh? Like CTSG,
yeah,
NZSIS doesn't quite have the buzz.
Even MI5 or MI6 doesn't ring true, you know, next to CIA.
Well, I quite like MI5, sound of MI5.
Yeah, well, there we go. I mean, but you're likely to say that, isn't it? You bloody limey.
Yeah, exactly. Can't beat them, eh? Aston Martins and MI5, Bond.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Bond girls, you know. I mean, that's what attracts people into MI5, for sure.
Yeah, and blowing up Irishmen.
Mm.
Of course. Yeah.
Oh, why would?
Yeah, that's what they're good at, right?
Yeah. I mean, seriously. Terrible. Why do you think the Irish are so into their alcohol? So the eyewitness reports could always be discredited via cross-examination by counsel. Now, that's a conspiracy theory. Oh, man. Hey, it's real funny, bro, how in the truth movement, right, the threat of COINTELPRO is worse than the actual presence.
It's amazing.
People stop forming groups, or people stop actually being activists based upon their fear of somebody else possibly being COINTELPRO with no evidence. That shoots you in the foot, right, doesn't it? United we stand, divided we fall.
What they're doing is effectively acting as if everyone is COINTEL and having the desired effect that COINTEL would by not wanting to speak to certain people and do certain things. I suppose that fulfills the agenda without COINTEL even having to exist. Because I can tell you, folks, yeah. Vinny ain't no COINTEL agent. If you've seen him, know him, and know him personally, he's, yeah. He must be the lowest paid agent I know. Why?
Yep, and it sucks. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back.
Oh, yeah. Tonight we're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday. And Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh, yeah. Sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh, yeah. It's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
That's what you mean. You mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business. It's business time.
Oh, yeah. That's right. We go brush
right.
our teeth. That's all part
Ladies
of it.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Play. You go
That's all part of
recycling.
It. Let's.
That's not part of it, but it's really important.
Excuse me. We have a very special guest on the line. It's Matthew Stein. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, you've been doing a bit of research, haven't you, into energy and in the unconventional senses, of course. I was wondering if you might give us a breakdown of who you are and what it is you do.
Well, I'm a mechanical engineer. I got a Bachelor of Science degree from MIT, and I do lots of different things in the design world. Right now I'm working on some hydrogen generation and hydrogen compression technology, and but I'm also the author of When Technology Fails. So it's kind of a funny mix. Here I am, the MIT engineer who designs everything from headsets and disk drives to medical filters and machinery and solar panels and hydrogen equipment. But I also write about the failure of technology in book, When Technology Fails. Yeah.
So what are some of the failures of technology? I mean, we talk a little bit about the show on the Zeitgeist movement with this resource-based economy and using technology to solve man's woes. What's your take on that?
Well, the main problem, I mean, technology fails on small degrees, like all the time. I mean, we're always having little internet failures and, you know, your BlackBerry's not working or whatever. Things are going on all the time. But what I'm talking about for technology failures is the big picture failures. Right now, see, we have six major trends in the world, each of which are headed towards collapse. Like, as a scientifically trained guy, you know, when you draw the graph, if it's a graph with a line that's heading steeply down towards the bottom, if you don't do something different, that line that's headed for the bottom is going to continue until it hits the bottom, which means crash. And so right now, we have a beautifully orchestrated, complex world that where everything depends on everything else for just-in-time delivery and for internet to work and satellite communications and all of these things. And it's a very big, complex machine, and it seems to work quite beautifully, you know, little glitches here and there, but overall pretty well. But the unfortunate thing is that each of these six major trends are headed for the wall, and so far, we haven't done a thing to significantly slow one of these trends, not to mention, you know, all six of them. So, do you want me to go into those trends right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, where are we today?
Well, where we are today, okay, so the first one is global climate change, or global weirding is what some people call it. It's not necessarily always warming. We're destabilizing the systems that have made for a fairly stable climate on the planet. I mean, put it this way, there's always been changes like volcanic activity that's beyond human beings and, you know, solar fluctuations and orbital fluctuations that do affect our weather in a big way. But right now, what's happened, which has never happened before, at least not in recorded history, is mankind is affecting the weather in a big way. So what we're doing is changing the atmosphere with a bunch of things like carbon dioxide and methane gases and moisture in the air. And all of those contribute to the stability of our weather and to the temperature on the planet. Now, I know, you know, like in places in Australia, boy, they had some real killer fires in the last few years. And in California, we've had some killer fires. And right now in China and India, the breadbaskets that feed 40% of the population of the planet, you know, more than a third of the population of the planet, those bread baskets are cooking right now in China and India, and they're frying, and they're not. They're having major harvest problems, and similarly in the Soviet Union, they're having fires and harvest problems. So we're kind of putting a monkey wrench in the spokes right there, and so that's number one. And if you want to ask me questions about it, like, you know, there's some people who say it's not happening and it's an Al Gore hoax, but I got a lot of information on that side on that. So let's just move. I'll just skim through all six of them first, and then you can come back and ask me specific questions and grow me on any of them if you want. So number two.
Will's going to love this. But go ahead.
Okay. Number two is the peak in world oil production. Now, you know, the world lives, eats, sleeps, and you know what's oil. I mean, it's oil is what the grease in the system that powers everything that makes it go round. And, you know, people estimate that without oil and fossil fuels, that the sustainable, you know, capacity to support human beings on the planet, something like 1.5 billion. Now, the right way to use technology is to, while we still have oil and coal and all those cool things to use, is to use that those resources wisely and develop the high-tech energy, alternative energy things, so that when those fossil fuels go down, which they're going down right now, that we have the alternatives. Otherwise, it's kind of like bye-bye civilization back to the Stone Age. So here's the story on oil. I mean, the International Energy Association has been, a lot of governments in the world base their projections for energy usage and availability based on these International Energy Association predictions. Now, up until 2 years ago, they were saying, don't worry, peak oil is like, you know, 15 years away, and everything's fine, and there's nothing to worry about. Then in 2008, they published a report that said, oh, you know, last year we decided that the world's oil fields were depleting at about 3%, and we can easily find enough oil and develop enough new oil to make up for that. But in 2008, they published an exhaustive report saying, you know, it's the world's oil fields are actually depleting at like 9.1%. And if we spend a lot of money and, you know, pump gas and CO2 and seawater and special chemicals down these oil wells for enhanced oil recovery, well, then it's only 6.4%. And you say, okay, what do those numbers mean? Well, those numbers mean that we need to discover and develop every few years a new Saudi Arabia's worth of oil, and it ain't going to happen. I mean, it just isn't out there. And so it's like no matter what we do right now, there's no way we can drill our way out of it. I mean, essentially, since the 1970s oil crisis, when the Arab Middle East people put the squeeze on the world and production, Ronald Reagan went out and did drill, and they drilled Indonesia, and they drilled Mexico, and they drilled, you know, the North Slope, and they drilled all over the world to get us off the Arab oil habit. Well, that worked great for about 25 years, but it's, you know, it's not working great anymore. We're on the downslide right now, and we either do something about it, or we got, like, you're going to see a global economic crisis in the world that's going to make the last few years look like a picnic if we don't do something and do something fast about it. And there's no way we can do something about it in terms of drilling more oil. I mean, it's just not there. We've seen, like, drilling in the bottom of the Gulf and how difficult that is, and, you know, 5,000 feet below the ocean and then another 10,000 feet, you know, below the bottom of the seafloor, 15,000 feet down in the deep sea to get that oil. You know, if the easy to get to oil was abundantly there, they wouldn't be going into tough places like the deep ocean and the Gulf and the North Sea, you know, the far north.
Really? Or what could it be true? Could it be true, Matt, that these companies want to create the illusion of scarcity to drive up the demand?
Well,
to drive the price up. There's
the demand. The demand is always driving, and the problem is that right now in the last year, 2 years ago, that was happening to some extent. And what the world saw was that when oil hit with a very healthy boom economy in the world, I mean, the economy was booming. And when oil hit $150 a barrel, it collapsed the world's economy. It just collapsed. Now, we have never seen those prices get up that close before since, because the economy can't handle them. As soon as we start getting around $100 a barrel now, the economy starts tanking and collapsing. There is so much money to be made in the oil business that, believe me, and there's so much competition from different oil companies, different countries, different people in the ballpark. Believe me, if they had easy to get to oil, they'd be pumping it and selling it, you know, and they'd be doing that. Because right now, China is ramping up. India is ramping up. Both those countries' economies are still growing, even though ours aren't. They want the oil. So if the oil was there...
Forgive me for playing devil's advocate, though. Aren't these oil families the same sorts of people who collude and price fix and actually match each other to undermine people collectively? But it's like the argument that they wouldn't have done 9/11 because they had to blow up their financial centres and shut down Wall Street because it cost. Why would they attack themselves, you know? Why would they not drill the cheap oil? It's the same sort of
9/11, I agree with you on, that as an engineer, those buildings simply could not collapse the way they did. And especially, I actually have a good friend of mine that I was a buddy with at MIT who scored, he did a lot better financially than me. And he has the floor of an apartment in an old building across the street from the Twin Towers. So when the first tower came down, everyone in the building except for him left. And when the second tower came down across the street from his building, it blew out all the windows in his building, and a 2,000-pound chiller flew through the window 10 feet to his left and would have squashed him into smithereens if it had hit him and killed him in an instant. And then he left the building. But my point about this is that he pointed out where Building 7 was, way, way across the way and across the street from the actual main compound, where the two towers were. And his building was 10 times closer than Building 7. And his building was 100 years old, and yet there was no structural damage to his building. I mean, it blew all the windows out, it caused a tremendous amount of damage, but the building didn't need to be torn down, it needed to be revamped. And yet Building 7, a brand new, a new modern skyscraper-type building with concrete and steel, 10 times further away from the Twin Towers, magically catches on fire and magically implodes just like the towers do. So obviously there's collusion. But you see, this is much easier. The collusion there is, my guess is there was some moles inside the guys who were flying the airplanes. I do believe there were airplanes flown, and I do believe that there was, a carefully orchestrated thing. But, it was probably there was a couple hundred people involved in this whole thing, or maybe even 50 or 100 people, and so they could keep it quiet. There's hundreds of thousands of people involved in the oil industry in thousands of companies all around the world. Their ability to carefully... And I'm not saying these guys are saints. I mean, I think that it was god-awful evil what BP did in the Gulf. And I think that it's criminal negligence that went on that allowed the Gulf thing to happen. And I think it's criminal what's happened in terms of poisoning the Amazon and the Ecuador from Texaco and those those companies that have the oil wells there, poisoning indigenous people. So these are scummy, disgusting, corporations that don't have maybe some of them and some of the people in the corporations have a lot of ethics, but there's a lot of people that don't, obviously. So I'm not
absolutely
saying-
and they tend to float to the surface much like in a toilet bowl. Now, I'd love it if you'd continue on. You said there were six technology failures. What's the next one?
So the next one, they're not necessarily technology failures, but they're related to our modern, high-tech, global,
technologically global
economy, right.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so number three is collapse of the world's oceans. Now, the oceans are collapsing in multiple ways. Right now, 11 of 15 of the world's ocean fisheries are either in collapse or on the verge of collapse. Now, to give you an idea how serious this is, every day in the Canary Islands, a very disturbing thing washes up on the shores of Canary Islands, and it's dead black men and women, African men and women washing up dead in the Canary Islands. You say, well, how'd they get there, and why is that happening? Well, there were very healthy fisheries for millennia off the coast of Africa, and the local people, you know, for thousands of years, have gone out in their, they call them pierogies or something like that. They're sort of like 40-foot long rowboats with a sail on them, and they go out and they fish their coast. Well, as the fisheries around China, around India, not China, around Japan, around the Mediterranean Sea, around the North Sea, the Russian fisheries, the Japanese, you know, the Norwegians, they've been leaving their local fisheries because they're fished out and they're going other places. So what they've done
is... the Japanese have tried to come and steal fish from our waters as well.
That's right. So they're going down to these other places in the world and they're, you know, dragging their nets and they're wiping all the local fish out. So these African people are starving to death and they're desperate and they don't have high-tech fishing boats to go, you know, 500 miles offshore. So they got no food left. They got no way to support their families. They're starving, so they're getting in their boats and they're sailing for Europe and hoping that they'll have a better life in Europe. And what's happening is a lot of them are getting capsized and washed away to sea along the way and showing up dead in the Canary Islands. Now, it goes beyond just fishing the oceans. There's a Royal British study that was released a year ago saying that 73% of the world's zooplankton, which is a key part of the bottom of the food chain in the ocean, that 73% has disappeared between 1950 and now. And half of that has happened since 1990. So half of the world's zooplankton has gone away since 1990 and 73% since 1950. So you've got a big part of the bottom of the food chain going away. Now, another area, the coral reefs of the sea, those are kind of like the rainforests of the ocean. You know, they stabilize carbon from the atmosphere. All the limestone and cement that we use in our world was originally coral reefs. You know, at some point in time, took carbon out of the atmosphere and calcium in the ocean and made coral out of them, and then it becomes limestone. Now, the coral reefs went from, in the year 2000, there was something like 11% of the reefs were dead in the world, and it jumped to 20% by 2004. And then another 24% in danger of short-term collapse, another 20% in terms of long-term. So we're killing the oceans, and we're destroying the bottom of the food chain and the bottom of the oxygen cycle.
Absolutely. It's pretty bad ecological disasters that are happening all over the planet. And, you know, a lot of solutions are being proposed, and we'll get into that after the break. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back with our special guest, Matthew Stein. And the only COINTELPRO show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We have a special guest. It's Matthew Stein, author of When Technology Fails. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you.
And now, I'd love you to continue on. The last thing we were on is the collapse of the oceans and coral.
Yeah, so let's go to forests. Forest is number four. And so far we've hacked down about half of the world's forests. But most, and we've been doing that for, you know, thousands of years, but most of that's happened in the last 50 years. And so the forest, most people don't realize, but when you consider climate change and greenhouse gases, the contribution of deforestation has been calculated at 24%. Now, okay, that's just another engineering number. What does that mean? Well, it's nearly double what all the transportation factor in the world is. So you add up what all the planes, trains, automobiles, ships, boats, everything adds to and contributes to greenhouse gases, and you double that, and that's just barely more than what deforestation does. Now, if you take all of the industry in the world, all of the, you know, all of the industrial processes, making cement and doing this, that, and the other thing, and you double that, that's equal to just a little bit more than deforestation. So deforestation is a really, really big deal. The other thing that happens is that when you cut a tree down, you start affecting the water and the weather cycles. And people say, well, why is that? Well, each tree, supposedly one huge, you know, one large mature tree, whether it's got pine needles or leaves, supposedly has the equivalent evaporative surface area of a 40-acre lake. Now, I haven't calculated the number myself. That's a number I've read. I kind of doubt it's that huge, but it's big. It's a big number. So what happens when you cut the trees down is the trees are each like giant water pumps. So the rain falls down and it gets sucked up by the roots and it evaporates out the leaves and needles and goes back in the atmosphere. So when you cut the trees down, you get something called desertification. And it's not Ben and Jerry's dessert, it's making a desert downwind. So think about it. The cradle of modern civilization was called the Fertile Crescent. It was between the Tigris and Euphrates River. Now that's where Iraq is now. Now, that was like the Garden of Eden 5,000 years ago, and it was so beautiful and such a wonderful climate that humanity blossomed, and they grew lots of people, and they made cities, and they cut all the trees down, and then it started turning to desert. So that's what we're kind of doing all over the planet. So who could have imagined that the rainforest in Indonesia would have burned until they did a few years ago? So as we cut down the rainforest in the Amazon and Indonesia, we start getting rid of all these giant water pumps. We start changing the global weather patterns. Okay, number five. Number five is the food crisis. See, a few hundred years ago, we started the Industrial Revolution, and we started making machines, and we started modern farming methods, and we started feeding a population of the world that grew many times. And we've had this green revolution that every year we were growing more and more food on the planet up until a few years ago. Now we're starting to have less food on the planet, and that's because of a combination of water crisis and loss of soils and climate change. So all of those together, and those are a part of the impact of the human beings on the planet. 40% of the world's food comes from irrigated cropland, and only 16% of the cropland is irrigated, but 40% of our food comes from that. Little 16% of the cropland that's irrigated makes 40% of our food. Now we're starting to have irrigation losses. We're getting salination. We're having entire rivers that don't even reach the ocean anymore. I mean, the Yellow River in China first didn't reach the ocean in the 1970s for like 5 days of the year. Well, a few years ago, it didn't reach the ocean for something like 280 days of the year. And there's major six major rivers around the world that don't reach the ocean or reach it as a trickle for part of the year because of what we're doing with the water. So we're really messing things up. And in the last 2 years ago, there was huge riots for food riots in many of the third world countries. And I think we're seeing another crisis coming up this year because of the crop failures in not only in the Soviet Union, but also in China and India. And then the big one, this is the big one, is number six, and it's the elephant in the room that politicians like to avoid, and it's called population. Now, let me give you some pictures in your mind that'll give you an idea of what's been happening in the world. Roughly 10,000 years ago, there was a great flood, a cataclysm. In the Bible, it's Noah and the Ark, and in the Sumerian tablets, it's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. So there's some kind of big catastrophe in the planet, asteroid, who knows what it was. Anyway, you know, in the Bible, it was God's wrath raining down on the planet, but who knows. Anyway, it wiped the slate clean, and there was very few people in the world. And back around the time Jesus was born, there was something like 250 million people in the world. And then it took about 1,000 years to double that to 500 million people around the year 1000. Well, it took another 800 years to make the first billion, to double that half billion, 800 more years in the year 1800. Well, it took 130 years to double that to 2 billion in the year 1930. Now, when I was a kid in the early 60s, we had 3 billion on the planet. And in the year 2000, we reached 6 billion. So that took only 40 years to double. Now, we're coming up on sometime in the next year or so, we're going to reach 7 billion people. So now here's just a startling thing to think about. From the time that Jesus was born to the time that Abraham Lincoln was born, they added fewer people to the planet than we added in the last 10 years. And between the year 2000 and the year 2012, we'll have added more population to the planet than the entire population of the world in the year 1800, just 200 years ago. So it's like we're taking an entire planet's worth of people from 200 years ago and adding them every 11 years now to this world. You know, we just can't keep it up. We just can't do that. So that's number six. Now, there are solutions, but what I'm going to tell you is that if we keep doing the same thing over, we're going to get the same result. And all of these trends are headed for collapse individually, and we're going to have the perfect storm of collapse if we don't take the bull by the horns and start doing something different.
Now, specifically, what are these different things that you recommend we should do?
Okay, well, specifically, you know, one thing is we're going to have to get the population thing under control. You know, that's a really big one. And that's going to involve working actively with the third world countries. See, wherever the women of the world are educated and have access to birth control, then the population rate comes down pretty nicely. The problem is that we have this thing about, like, shipping off drugs to the third world to help, you know, reduce infant mortality, which is a good thing. I mean, nobody likes to see their child die, but we're not helping them educate, and we're not helping the women rise to the point where they'll take control themselves. Now, there's a really wonderful initiative called Global Population Media, Global Population Initiative, and they're working on educational programs where they go to these places in different parts of the world where population is really out of control, and they get local writers, both on the radio and TV. Now, some of these places have TV and some are just radio. And they basically use local writers to come up with these really wonderful, dramatic sort of soap operas, like extended miniseries things. And they talk about what's going on in you know, they create a story that people get wrapped up in. Like, for instance, in Africa, they had the story of this truck driver, and he was a studly guy and really good looking, and he had his wife at home, and he was driving around to different places, and he had mistresses in different areas, and, you know, and he fathered children everywhere, but he also picked up AIDS and spread AIDS. So people get kind of wrapped up with, like, the storyline, and then they start feeding in things like, you know, condom usage and preventing AIDS, and that it's really, and that, you know, it's not a good thing to have six kids when you can't support your family with, you know, where you are now, and those kids are going to want to have kids, and you're dividing your land smaller and smaller. I mean, Rwanda, they had a population growth of something like 6 to 1 in the last 60 years, and they ended up having the big giant ecocide and genocide there because people were starving and they were so cramped and you know, everything got out of hand, and one tribe basically went to slaughter the other tribe so they could get all their land. And it's a matter of too many people and, you know, too many eaters and poopers and not enough food to go around, and everyone start killing each other. And that's the kind of future we got if we don't, like, do the right thing.
Well, I understand that there is kind of a massive food crisis going right now. I also understand that the average American consumes 7 times as much as the average African. So it's kind of a bit asinine to say something like that. And on top of it, we've got the eugenics programs coming through the UN, where they're
putting a lot of toxic vaccines into Africa, and our former Prime Minister here in New Zealand, Helen Clark, is now chief of the UN Development Program, which is a $9 billion budget to dispense more or less a whole lot of toxic vaccines and sterilants among the population without their consent, and in some cases without their will. And the West has been kind of plundering the third world for a long, long time. It's about resources, and we've got the resources to feed all these people. Absolutely, we do. It's just we don't, because they're the useless eaters. They deserve to die. In the words of Henry Kissinger himself, depopulation to the third world is one of the most important things to get rid of all them useless eaters. And Kissinger was one of the orchestrators of the peak oil crisis as well. Back in the 70s, he went into the, what's it called, into the Middle East, and told them all he'd make them rich, you know, and he had these conditions. One of them was they'd sell the oil based on US dollars, and second condition was they had to buy the US national debt. And this is all right there in the documents, so I'm not just making this up. And after he got them to invest all their infrastructure into making the oil industry their number one, he then told them to buy lots and lots of gold, right? And it was quite interesting how the scam works here, because the gold market and the oil markets are manipulated too through the IMF and World Bank, who can flood or suck out the liquidity of the resources that are available in that market in order to produce things like financial crises, gold price hikes, or oil price hikes, as was the case during the oil price shock, which incidentally the wells in Texas that supposedly went all dry are now full of oil again.
I know people in the oil business who are making, I know people at Planet Resource Technology that are making a nanoparticle product to be pumped down oil wells, and what it does is it debinds the oil from the soils. Because when you have an oil well, I mean, when it's quote dry, there's still half the oil left in the ground. It's just it's stuck to stuff, and it's not freed up, so it's much harder to get out. So it's natural when an oil well sits for a long time that a little bit of that oil that was sort of stuck in little pockets kind of migrates back there. So it resuscitates a little bit. But I know these people, and they're going out to oil wells that are...
Hold on, I'll just stop you there. If it resuscitates at all, how could it be a fossil fuel? Because I understand that the La Brea tar pits in Los Angeles, when they were studied, they became one of the prime examples of why oil was a fossil fuel. And here was the logic. In the La Brea tar pits, which are mostly oil, there were a whole bunch of dinosaur bones and plants and stuff like this within the oil. So they said, oil must be made from dinosaur bones and plants because this oil's got dinosaur bones and plants in it. Same principle as looking at a vodka martini with an olive in it and saying, hey, this vodka martini must be made out of olives because it's got olives in it.
Well, it goes a lot further than that, and it's possible that there's adiabatic oil regeneration in the world. But it's certainly, if you look at what Saudi Arabia is doing with pumping seawater, and they can see that from satellites, that, you know, if those fields are regenerating, then they wouldn't be spending all that money to pump all the seawater down there to keep things going.
The Russians have discovered some wonderful deep core drilling techniques, but we'll get into that after the break. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. Our very special guest is the author of When Technology Fails, Matthew Stein, and we'll be back after the break.
Me driving and I won't stop, and it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, I'll let them all die in exasperation, have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them, and I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, in a holocaust.
Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. We have a very special guest on the line still with us, Matthew Stein from When Technology Fails. Do you have a website, Matthew?
Sure, the website is www.whentechfails.com, WHENTECHFAILS.com. And I just want to encourage you guys because, you know, there's a lot of major stuff coming down in the world, and half of my book is about living sustainably, kind of green and clean and healthy, while things are still working well. And the other half is about how you plan for and deal with the bumps in the road. And my opinion is that if we do everything right, we're going to have some major bumps in the road. And it's going to be tough to make it through those okay. And my book is about helping people plan to do that. And if we don't do everything right, then we're going to, you know, we're going to be somewhere around the Mad Max future, which is not something that I think anybody really wants. And, you know, maybe I agree that there are mean, nasty people in the world, and that there are conspiracies to control the economy of the world and make lots of money. But there is no profit to be made in a dead planet. And if they collapse the world through what we're doing,
well, that would be based on the. That would just be based on the assumption that all they want is profit. Control is a heck of a lot more profitable than profit itself.
Exactly, Matt. I mean, are you totally aware of the corruption of the financial system? Like you, I mean, to use the arguments that corporations wouldn't spend money here, wouldn't spend negative equity there, money's nothing to these guys. Money's nothing. Like, they understand what it is. It's a control mechanism for us.
Yeah, we just yesterday we had Doc Bean on the show. He's talking about the Bloomberg just released the national debt for the United States. It's 200 plus trillion per year.
Yeah.
All right. All this money's being made up out of absolute thin air, and it's being used to put the squeeze on people because everybody agrees that this thing we call money actually has value as a means of trade. And the reality being nowadays with a mouse click, you get $1 trillion, right? And there's no resources and there's no capital that actually goes into making that. And when you get no resources and no capital in exchange for something that is resources or is capital, it's either a gift or it's fraud, right? Okay.
Yeah. And doesn't it make you wonder that when, like, some of, like, Matt, like, you're, I'm not suggesting anything, but that, I'm not suggesting you're dishonest in any way, but a lot of your, say, recipe for what's coming to the end of the world, as it were, and I agree that we are coming to a huge crossroads here.
Oh yeah.
Is similar to what I've heard from the UN. It's very similar. It's climate change, it's peak oil, it's overpopulation, and the main points are very, very similar, and some of the solutions are similar too, but. We can get further into that, obviously, but I just tend to think that I know the globalists have created a lot of problems on this planet, and now saying, look, you're so bad, humanity, we need to impose laws and systems upon you in order to get us out of this system, this problem.
Well, look at it this way. You've got, you know, politicians can state facts, can state opinion as if they're facts. They can say, well, this guy proved in front of Congress that, you know, global warming and climate change is a farce. And it's like, no. You see, a politician can say that. And a radio guy can say that.
But most politicians are on your side when it comes to climate change. Right. Ever wonder why that might be?
So are most media people and everything else. And the solutions that are being proposed are to climate change, and I agree the climate is changing within the last, eight years or something. We've had a 0.7 degree Fahrenheit drop in global temperature.
That's actually bogus. You haven't had a 0.7 degree drop. But what you do have is a good scientist.
Well, it's happening throughout the solar system is the problem. I mean, we've had frozen moons around Jupiter be turned into these liquid seas, and the polar ice caps on Mars are receding as well. So there's a solar element, indeed, with our climate change too. And we're talking about, like, compound contributors here, like CO2, yes, does affect the atmosphere. Water vapor does affect the atmosphere. Argon does affect the atmosphere. And it's like all these little things all working together. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think something like a large proportion of methane is done by animals dying in the jungles and decomposition of foliage and things like that over large forested areas. And indeed, plankton is one of the most important things to help balance out the atmosphere through oxygen. Now, with the depletion and the pollution of the oceans, with a whole bunch of God knows what being dumped into it, there's now, it's basically like this plastic soup, you know, and life is dying all over the place. So we get that there's an ecological crisis. The point Will and I are making here is that many of these problems were created specifically with the intention of making humanity seem to be the problem, to make population the problem, so that they can come in and propose their solution, which is global control of resources in a very hardcore socialist model. And if you have a look at the UN, historically, they have supported brutal socialists to a T, and indeed, and ironically enough, former Nazi high-level commanders who have not prosecuted in Nuremberg indeed became Secretary General of the UN. And we've got this terrible crisis, yes, but we are cautious, in the truth movement at least, that we don't fall into some of these UN traps. And many, many people do fall into them because it's an immense amount of research to go into. I personally watched something in excess of 160 documentaries in 6 months in order to gain the bulk of what I know about certain things to do with the UN. So she's a big, complex issue. And we'll get into this far more with our fabulous guest, Matthew Stein, after the break. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. It's all about unity. The unity, ladies and gentlemen, it's harder than one might think. And we have hearty discussions on this show, and we're just talking over the break about how we're not hey, in fact, I think it's a two-way street here, don't you think? Is that both of us on this side of the coin here, me and Will and our fabulous guest here, are covering over territory we've already covered before. And when you do that, and it happens very often in, say, the truth movement or in anything like that, then we try to move on to the intelligent debate. Now it is hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. And we'd like to give a quick plug to our sponsors. Your Uncensored magazine, if you go to the vinnieeastwoodshow.com, you can buy this great as just as good as Time magazine in terms of the quality, the colour, the articles, all top notch. And you will get some ridiculously good information out of this puppy. They were the first magazine in New Zealand to break the 9/11 was an inside job story. No small feat there. And also the editor of Uncensored magazine is also the author of Suppressed Inventions and Other Discoveries, which is based on about 40 years of research. Very, very interesting book indeed, covering a whole bunch of cancer cures, alternative energy, free energy technologies, and even anti-gravity. And the cover-ups of all of these as perpetrated by the medical establishment and the general oil establishment.
Now, so the funny thing is, what we're delving into here, Vinnie, as you say, we've repeated this before, we've gone over this before, and we have. But I like to think, you know, I've got an open mind, and I would, you know, if the evidence come about, I would flip-flop and start saying, yeah, climate change. But from what I've seen, you know, you talk about, Matt, how you agree 9/11 was an inside job.
Yeah, well,
If you go and look at any of the opinions from any of the mainstream guys who tout climate change, they will say that's a ridiculous conspiracy theory peddled by the same sort of people who are climate deniers. And now, just as we are right about being climate deniers, we are right about 9/11. And just as they are wrong about the Arabs during 9/11, in my mind, they are wrong about global warming and their support of the UN. And on your own website, you talk about the threat of terrorism. Are you aware that the Council on Foreign Relations, I'll get the direct quote for you in a minute, talked about how they could use, in the 70s, Council on Foreign Relations said we could use the threat of terrorism and environmentalism to make man the enemy in order for us to push through our agenda. So getting the left wing on environmentalism, getting the right wing on terrorism.
But I will say that terrorism is not something that I tend to focus on. Like, if you notice my 6 threats to the world, none of them include terrorism. And in my book, I do talk about the peak oil threat, the eco threat, which is kind of most of those 6 threats all put together, and the bio threat, meaning the threat of new superbugs, both viruses and bacteria, both generated by man and generated by happenstance and transmitted around the world through global travel. And terrorism is kind of the last on my list. And I admit,
I'm just reading off whentechfails.com. And this is main threats to our future: peak oil, eco threat, and global warming, bio threat, just what you're talking about, mass plagues, and the terror threat.
Right.
And to me, that's all like, whoa. It's like, to me, that's kind of the same points that they use.
Yeah, well, terror threat is, again, it's number 4, but when I talk about what's really threatening the world, it's 9/11. So that's kind of like the newer thing I focus on doesn't even include the terrorism. But I'll admit, I believe that.
We'll get into the solutions after the break. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Oh yes.
I take my anger to a place that ain't gonna get up in your face. The facts we okay, but the system fails. We got to change the way we see the problem if we're gonna fix this place. My living soul don't care about the color of your face. Unite and roll, respect our right to live here on the land. It's Dino Ranga, Tina Tonga, we don't know the banks. The parliament does so where do you ever stand? They paying their bills off your back with hefty tax demands. Misleading our youth with alcohol, TV contrabands. So kids act up and disturb our community. Uninformed public then consents to a planned absurdity. What? Replace our human rights with commercial slavery. They print a $100 and loan it to you. They charge interest on the loan but don't print the interest. So there'll never be enough money to pay off all the debt. What do you get? Crash and burn. When will my people learn the truth? Come on now, before it's too late. Hey, I got a new law for you. Let's make charging interest illegal and I'll tear it all.
So oh yeah! Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that is all about COINTELPRO, the Vinny Eastwood Show, with Will on American Freedom Radio, and incidentally, the VinnyEastwoodShow.com, where we do an exclusive R18 podcast after every show. No FCC regulations. It's our little way at the Vinny Eastwood Show of saying F you to the FCC. And our special guest is Matthew Stein, author of When Technology Fails, and we were going to get into the solutions. Now, let's say today the economy collapses, major depression comes down, there's no food. It's basically the OMG, WTF, FFS kind of scenario. Globally, what could the average person do to survive under such circumstance?
Well, hopefully you got a copy of my book in your back pocket. But under such circumstances, then you're going to have to worry about food, water, shelter, clothing, and healing yourself. And certainly water is the biggest one. Because most of us could live about a month without food, or at least a month without food, especially the fat Americans. Some of them could go for 6 months, maybe. But you may not believe it, you may not like it, you may not feel good, but you could do it. But in 3 days without water, you're in major trouble. Let me just tell you a story to illustrate this. Back in the 1984, probably the climate was starting to change already, and we just didn't know anything about it, nobody talked about it, but I was climbing El Capitan in Yosemite Valley on Memorial Day weekend. So I brought the standard, my partner and I, this is a 3,000-foot straight vertical wall. You know, it's a cliff, 3,000 feet, like two Empire State Buildings on top of each other, stacked on top of each other. It's that tall. And my buddy and I bought the standard 2 quarts per person per day. Well, what we didn't count on was record-breaking heat. I mean, we'd start out climbing in our T-shirts and shorts at 6 in the morning, and come mid-afternoon, it would be about 110 on the south-facing walls, and we were just dying. And we could have easily drunk all the water we had left with breakfast on day three, and you know we still had about 1,000 feet of climbing to go. And by the middle of the day, we ran out, and I dropped my last grapefruit. I mean, I just about cried when I dropped this grapefruit and started, you know, bouncing down 2,000 feet. Like, oh,
no!
I was so thirsty. My partner asked me a question. You're up 100 feet above him on the cliff, and he asked me some question. I'm leaning out on the rock. I start answering, my tongue would stick to the roof of my mouth like super glue, and I'd start gagging and retching. It'd be like, I'd try to answer and be like, and so we climbed, we got our headlamps and climbed until about midnight, and we found the nearest mud puddle, and we stuck our faces in it and drank. And believe me, if you are thirsty like that, you will drink the most scummy, disgusting duck pond or ditch water if that's all you got to drink. So, you know, I have a whole chapter devoted to water and how do you purify it and treat it, what nifty high-tech gadgets should you have just in case, and if you're stuck and all the high-tech gadgets have broken or failed or you don't happen to have them with you and things fell apart, how do you purify water the low-tech way? You know, how do you make a sand filter? How do you do solar disinfection? How do you make a SARI filter? Now, it's not S-O-R-R-Y, it's S-A-R-I. And they use Indian SARIs. They teach village people in India to fold the SARI over 6 times and then strap it around the neck of a bottle or a jug. And that'll filter out, it won't get rid of everything, but it decreases waterborne diseases by more than a factor of 2 to 1. So it's not perfect, but it's better than nothing. So
I totally agree on the survivalist tactics. I tend to think that most people in the major cities are just going to be, you know, screwed water-wise. I tend to think that, yeah, collecting rainwater off your roof makes sense.
Oh, yeah. If you're in a place
in an urban area like that. You know, what's that, sorry?
I mean, if you're in the dry side of Australia, you could be in pretty bad shape.
Yeah, you'd be in trouble. Unless you have storage.
Auckland, New Zealand, you know, rain off the roof is a pretty good thing. You know,
I really just wanted to wade straight in here and talk more about the whole climate change debate, because me and Vinny are always bagging on climate changes, but there's no one to respond, and we need to hear both sides.
Okay.
And so, well, you know, I'm really sick of hearing the media. I'm sitting down eating dinner last night, and close up on TVNZ and TV1 here in New Zealand starts talking about things based upon the premise of climate change, but they don't ever debate the premise. They run away with
the premise.
So the premise is that CO2 causes warming. Premise fail number one. CO2 causes warming. So it's an increase in temperature preceding an increase in CO2 by 400 to 800 years. This corresponds with the fact that the oceans contribute 150 gigatons per annum of CO2 to the atmosphere compared to man's 6.6 per se, and that the ocean takes a huge amount of time to heat the huge mass of water, which has like a specific heat capacity of 4,400 kilojoules per mole, or like water can absorb a huge amount of heat, so that's why there's that time delay.
There's a huge delay.
Yeah, and so ice core records show that CO2 doesn't increase temperature. No, that temperature increases CO2. And what we also know is that the oceans, decaying flora and fauna alone produce more than hundreds of times more than humans.
Well, CO2. You see, what you have is a balance.
How does man then drive that engine?
You have
of
you have a balance in the world, and you have a variety of things. So you have, like I said,
let him speak, please.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of factors. So good global scientists are overlaying all these different factors. So, for instance, last winter in the Northern Hemisphere was kind of like a good old days winter, like a real knock your socks off winter in the Northern Hemisphere, in the central latitudes. And people said, oh, see, global warming's a farce. It's a farce. Now, what it is, though, the good scientists look at it and say, okay, in the Northern Hemisphere, you have the aerosol cooling effect, which is actually why Stephen Schneider had been predicting the coming ice age, you know, back in the 70s, and then it changed. Because back then, they had overestimated the global cooling effect due to pollutant aerosols by a factor of 4 to 1, and they'd underestimated the greenhouse effects by a factor of 2 to 1, because they were focusing on just CO2. And it turned out that when you add CFCs and methanes and other things in there that are part of our modern society, then that doubled the greenhouse effect. So what it turned out was that they overestimated the cooling effect by 4 to 1 and underestimated the heating effect by 2 to 1. So good scientists then readjust the equations and looks at it and changes it. Now, last winter, what happened? What made it cooler? Well, the cooling effect from aerosol pollutants in the Northern Hemisphere counteracts about half of the normal greenhouse effects that we've seen so far to date in the Northern Hemisphere, not so much in the Southern Hemisphere, because most of the pollution is in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, when you then add that with the solar minimum, so that's the effect of the sun, then we had a solar minimum, so that meant it was cooler on the planet from that. So in the central latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere, we basically had a winter like the good old days. It seemed like global warming was hokey. But in the Southern Hemisphere, where they didn't have all of the aerosol cooling from pollutants, but they still had the solar minimum going on, then it meant that it was warmer than normal, but not a record breaker. Now, this year is going towards record breaking. Now,
I don't believe in any of those storm in arguments, though. I'm talking about CO2.
It's a combination, you know, they look at CO2, they look at methanes, they look at all of the different things combined.
Not water vapor, though.
It's true that if you have huge volcanic effects, if you have an asteroid effect, when you have Jupiter and Saturn kind of line up with the Earth, which happens once in a blue moon, I mean, much less than a real blue moon, but it happens very, you know, very long term. And that's like a complicated astrophysics kind of equation to figure out when that happens. It's not like it happens every 10 years or something like that. You know, it's a complicated thing because all of these different planets are going around. And, you know, a year on Earth is very different from a year, one time around the world, around the sun for Mars, one time around for Jupiter, one time around for Saturn. Every planet is...
These are all things out of our control, yeah. These are all...
Right, they're out of our control, but what they can do is they can go back and look, take astrophysics records, and say, okay, during this period of time, say, I'm just pulling a number out of you know where. I mean, I don't know the number because I'm not an astrophysicist. Say 13,000 years ago, Jupiter and Saturn were lined up with the Earth, and they pulled our orbit further out, so it gave us like a 5,000-year glacial ice age because of that. Now, naturally, when you've got a lot of ice in the planet, then you're going to have a lot less plant life that's putting out oxygen. So you have a higher CO2. CO2 will start to raise. Oxygen will lower. That will help flip us out of an ice age and back into a warming period. So those are kind of...
But we don't have high CO2. We've had... During the Cambrian period, when the dinosaurs were around, we had up to 7,000 parts per million, according to the ice core records. Okay, and
it's very high CO2.
Yeah. Right now we have 385 parts per million, and then we've got these guys running around 350.org saying, as soon as we get to 349, it's like party time, the world's saved. When the New World Order still run the place, they still issue the fiat currency, everything else is ignored, there's still bisphenol away in the plastic water bottles, no one cares about any of those real environmental... There's still genetic modification going on. None of that's mentioned. Because it's a globalist-backed course.
I'm just laying it out here.
Like, there's just so much circumstantial and then actual physical evidence as to why this is a scam.
There was very high CO2. Hundreds of millions of years ago, there was extremely high CO2 in the planet, and there was no animal life from the plant because there wasn't enough oxygen around. So then as the plant life grew and it started producing more oxygen, reducing CO2 levels, then it starts shifting things and becomes more suitable for human beings, or well, for animals. I mean, it took a long time for human beings to come around. So now we can go back to that stage where you got tons of CO2 and animals, or I mean, plant life's going great in the planet, but animals can't live on the planet. I mean, we could
isn't that what the UN wants to kill everyone off? I mean,
no. I'm saying what we
isn't
need.
Doesn't that solve the population problem?
We have massive, massive numbers of species that are going extinct at a record-breaking rate now. I mean, huge, like an asteroid hit, only there's no asteroid. It's the asteroid is us, it's people. And so, yeah, we can wipe it out. And believe me, the planet would be just fine without human beings. I mean, the planet would be like a lot better off without us. You know, we're the big plague on the planet right now. I mean, it's like we're the plague of locusts on this planet Earth right now.
So if people really think we're a plague, and if really people really think that we're not part of an organic system, that we're not organic ourselves, I ask them
Here's an example right now of how nature deals with imbalance. It's called overshooting clouds. Okay, so here's an example. Now, in 1944. There was this island in the Bering Sea called St. Matthew's Island. You know, it's just a remote island in between Alaska and the Soviet Union. And there was no predators in the island. And, you know, there's a bunch of seabirds and plant and algae and, you know, whatever. But they took some reindeer and they put them on the island. And they introduced it. So what did they do? So 1944, they put 29 reindeer on the island, okay? 1957, here these reindeer grow to 1,350 reindeer on the island because, you know, it's a nice island. There's, like, lots of food and there's no predators. It's great. It's, like, perfect. It's, like, you know, paradise for reindeer paradise. Now, 1963, from 57, it goes from 1,350 to 6,000 reindeer in 1963. Now, there's 6,000 on this island. Now, from looking at similar-sized islands and similar plant life, they estimated somewhere around 1,500, 2,000 was the sustainable limit for reindeer on the island. Well, now you got 6,000. You got like 3 to 4 times as many as the sustainable amount on the island. So what happens? They eat everything in sight, and the soil washes away, and the reindeer starve and eat absolutely everything, trying to keep themselves alive. And the population crashes to 42 in 1966. Now, that's how nature deals with an imbalance. It writes the balance, and it writes it through disease and famine and collapse. Now,
and I agree with that too. And all the UN guys are pantheist nature cult people. Why don't they agree that the planet will solve the population woes and the planet will regulate the temperature as it always has done for 4.5 billion years, and that the UN and Barack Obama and the leftists down the road don't need to do anything about it?
Well, they don't need to do anything about it. But if you like the idea of starvation and famine and collapse, getting rid of the plague of human beings, the locusts of human beings have overpopulated and are overconsuming the planet. And if you like that solution for a future, then fine. But personally,
I'd rather nature discriminate against men than other men thinking they're no more than lesser Africans discriminate against them.
Look at it this way. What if we were proactive? What if we said, you know, we can have a global renaissance on this planet. Right now, you know, in Africa, the people in Africa and in the third world and in Asia and South Pacific, they're living at about half of the global footprint of the planet. In other words, if the entire population lived like Asia Pacific then and Africa, then we could theoretically, provided that, you know, as long as the oil or some alternative holds out, we could support a population of twice as many people at that level of standard of living.
Yeah, they're suppressing the alternative to oil. And we don't have this footprint, as they speak of, because the science hasn't been confirmed. So we're still trying to argue the premise, and they say,
here's the standard of living of the United States, then it would take 4.5 to 5 planet Earth to support the standard of living of North America, Canada, and the United States. Now,
well,
we're going to
take
2 Europe's standard of living and probably 2 at the Kiwi standard of living.
What you're saying is,
I just kind of want to interject here with what I think, and I think that our society has been purposely created to be incredibly wasteful, so that a huge crisis will come about, so that certain people, namely the UN, the New World Order, the international banksters, can then say, okay, everybody's the problem. Now we need to have greater regulation and control over the resources, as opposed to a volunteer society where people just do it, like real environmentalists do, just to help the environment. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back with our guest. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio. Our special guest is Matthew Stein, the author of When Technology Fails. Is it whentechnologyfails.com?
Yeah, whentechfails.com. The subtitle of the book is A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. So that, like, very accurately describes the book. Self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency.
So when we talk sustainability, population-wise, this always comes up. And people like to say there's overpopulation. And the sort of people who say that also claim to be against genocide and freeing the West Bank and all the rest of it. But then talk about regulating and having birth controls and everything else. Now, the pill has caused disasters, a health catastrophe amongst our female population. All young girls just trusting doctors taking it. Health catastrophy. Okay,
that's one of them,
and that's one of the reasons why we have a lower fertility rate than a lot of the third world. Now, if you read some of the documents from Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, out of England, they had a strategy to allow the third world, which they colonised, their Indian colonies, their African colonies, to grow and develop at the rate they are, to be able to demonize them. It's like everything is literally a false flag. And then people just go, look, they're having six kids when they can't afford to, or don't have the resources to raise them. Look how irresponsible they are. We need to educate them. I mean, it's just so racist to start with. We are the elites. We know best. We are the guardians of Gaia, and we are going to
and the gods first.
Actually, I believe ones that know best. Like, there was a global conference, climate alternate conference, at Cochabamba last year, and in that conference they had a lot of indigenous peoples of the world leaders, and I think the indigenous peoples of the world know best.
They con the indigenous people into the UN stuff because it's all loving and leftist, and it goes against evil America Satan. But anyway, that's what they con a lot of the indigenous population in New Zealand to believe in climate change. They've conned a lot of the North American Indians.
Well, let's because get it's off all the climate
like we take
let's
people from anywhere and we put them in our round tables, just like the Masons do.
Because there's five other trends in the planet that are all headed for collapse. So say climate change isn't happening. Okay, fine, great. That's fine with me. Now, the last thing
is
the climate change is it peer-reviewed science papers. Now, like I said, I had a beer with Steven Schneider, and I said, you know, why did you predict that there was going to be an ice age, and then you switched to predicting that there's going to be climate, you know, global warming? And he said, well, because we overestimated the cooling factor of pollutant aerosols by 4 or 6 to 1. And we underestimated the greenhouse factor because we were ignoring all the other things in addition to CO2. So we underestimated by 2 to 1. So when you start readjusting and changing your equations based on observation, then you realize, oh, I screwed up before and that was wrong. Now, similarly, there's a danger.
How did you not screw it up again?
There's a danger.
How do we know?
You don't know for sure. And they said there's only a 9 out of 10 chance that human beings are responsible, are significantly changing the climate. Now, there's a 10% chance that we're wrong, that we screwed up, that we're missing things, and that we're wrong. So now tell me, which of you guys would get on a plane if they told you, look, buddy, what's your problem? There's only a 9 out of 10 chance that this plane's going to crash. So why don't you just get on that plane and not worry about it? Remember, hey, what's your problem? You get a 10% chance it's going to be okay.
But that makes perfect sense to a swim on the surface person. But to me, I would analyze how they arrived at that 9 out of 10 chance, what monies were involved in the decision-making process of the educated elite, ones who know best, who came up with that statistic in the first place. I mean, this is the whole premise of history. I believe in altruistic grassroots movements, not elitists telling the grassroots what to do. You need to get behind climate change. The UN's good. 350 is good. We need to stop terrorism, environmentalism, and the rise of sea levels. You know, like, I mean,
absolutely.
Okay,
now we've got this problem. Hold on a sec. We've got this problem with kind of social engineering, and now in times of great crisis, it usually fits the bill to have person to come in and position themselves to take advantage of the crisis. I'm just going to read you a quote from the Club of Rome, the first global revolution. The common enemy of humanity is man. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. Democracy is no longer well suited for the tasks ahead. It would seem that humans need a common motivation, namely a common adversary. Such a motivation must be found to bring the divided nations together to face an outside enemy, either a real one or else one invented for the purpose. That's from the first global revolution from the Club of Rome. And in the truth movement, we do delve in very, very much into other aspects which a vast majority of the population are scant even aware of. Occultic connections, for example. There's an awful lot of very, demon worshippers.
Yeah, we don't even get into that. I mean, we just want to talk science on the ground about climate change. But even that seems to get people going. I mean, like...
Well, the point I was trying to make, Will, is that we're trying to talk about... Yeah, well, yes. But the point is about the concept of evil and deception. Evil and deception are by no means an underestimated or under-examined threat because it is all-pervasive. You know, the many, many large societies that have immense amount of influence on the world, like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, etc., have immense amounts of powers at steering world events. And if you have a look at a lot of the funding sources behind many of these things that are being put forth as global crises like peak oil, climate change, population reduction, all the funding sources come from these very same consortium of private banks and all of that. And I find that the intelligent people among us are kind of easy to be deceived in many, many ways, because we believe in the good of science, and we our lives are day-to-day often governed more by belief in science rather than by science itself.
Well, I mean, why don't the anti-corps go after the Federal Reserve Bank? That is the biggest corporation on the planet, Matt, and they are the same ones who are benefiting from the climate tax and the climate change camp. Whether you agree with the tax or not, you are supporting it. Just like the people who agree that the Arabs did 9/11 are the reason why there's over a million dead Arabs right now. They are the reason.
I don't care about the tax. But what I will say is that there is a clear...
I do care about the tax.
Yeah, we'll just let him finish.
No, I'm just saying that the tax... I'm not saying that the tax is the solution to climate. And I'm not saying... I'm saying that there is a very clear climate conspiracy. And the clear climate conspiracy is on the part of the oil and fossil fuel companies that want to keep business going as usual. Now, if you look at, like, for instance, in Germany, they put in feed-in tariffs, and the feed-in tariffs accomplished in 6 years what the Bush administration said we couldn't do in 25 years here in America in terms of getting Germany off the oil habit. Now, they didn't get it off 100%, but they made so much progress in 6 years, it was more than we were saying in America we could. It would take us 25 years to do it. Now they can do it, we can do it. And they didn't do it through cap and trade. They did it other ways. I don't care about cap and trade. I care about what works. I want to see what works, changing the future course of our planet. That's what
I matters. Completely agree. And my favorite solution to climate change and or the dependence we have on so-called fossil fuels and all of that is get the oil companies to release all the suppressed technology that they have stolen from inventors over the last 100 years.
That would certainly be a decent start. I don't know how great that suppressed technology is.
Well, one example. Have you heard of Cameron Pogue, the Pogue carburetor? In 1936, I think it was, he invented a vaporizing carburetor. Now, the very first carburetor was actually made in 1886, I believe, and it used a wick. And normal engines, they use proper liquid fuel, and then they ignite the liquid and then get the energy from that, and it turns the wheels. What vaporizing does is it separates the liquid out into more droplets. The only reason why you actually have car exhaust is because it's unburned hydrocarbons. With a vaporizing carburetor, it separates all the molecules out so that they can all be burned up evenly. And instead of getting, a couple of miles to the gallon or whatever, he found out that you can get 200 miles a gallon. And this is something made before even World War II. And a man in Christchurch, not too long ago, in New Zealand here, I believe in the mid-90s, he made a car that ran from Christchurch to the top of the South Island, which was about maybe a 400-mile trip, round trip, and he did that on a shot glass of water. Okay, that and the day after he did that experiment, that trial, his house was broken into, his plans were stolen, and he was given $2 million and told that he can't tell anybody about any of it. Right. So let's take that as the base premise that we have the ability to have unlimited free energy. Okay.
Well,
it makes all these things a moot point because
I like to believe that those are all true. I know I got hired to work on a over unity engine, and the guy funding it had lots of money. He was a pretty wealthy individual, and supposedly was an ex NASA scientist, and that this engine was gonna, we were gonna produce it in secret and solve the world's energy problems, and he's put a couple $1 million into it and could never get it to work. And I was hired to make sure the bearings and the shafts and everything worked for mechanically, but I couldn't vouch for the super, woo-woo physics, but it never actually worked. So,
just remember Nikola Tesla, the father of alternating current. When he brought that in, his competitor, who was it? Well, it was a competitor, J.P. Morgan-funded guy anyway, said that alternating current was really dangerous and it shouldn't be allowed on the market. Same thing. Exactly.
It's ridiculous. George Soros
Nikola Tesla, like many great inventors, didn't need virtually any funding, did it all himself, okay, because you can't put a price on genius, okay, and we have a heck of a lot of genius out there that has already proven itself very, very well working, and it's being suppressed because genius is the enemy of tyranny. Because you can outwit tyrants, because tyrants only see things one way: profit, control. How much longer can I have control for? That's kind of the motivation.
They don't see the human. They don't see the human spirit, the dynamic human spirit, and that's exactly the human spirit that the people who want to, that the majority of black people in the United States haven't even been born; they've been aborted. I know a lot of people don't have a problem with abortion, but I actually think that when a baby has specialized cells, it's a human being, and no one seems to care about that. That's a whole bunch of people being killed off. That's helping curb the population problem. But you see, even if you deal with every single one of the 12 problems, you're still left with one big, huge problem, and that is that there is a esoteric, hidden, not so hidden these days, elite who aren't in politics, who are not in parliament,
Right, they're behind.
Who are not in Congress, and they are running the planet from their cozy villas and mansions in France and Switzerland.
Rothschild Manor!
Yeah, and they are laughing right now. They are laughing at this radio show. They are laughing at everyone because they've got it all sewn up. They control just about every single side.
Let's talk about something else.
They're still going to take over. You're going to solve all these problems, and there is going to be a global renaissance. It's going to be a brave new world, Orwellian dystopia, and they are going to solve the population problem too. And I don't think you're on their side. I don't think you're with them, so you should be concerned about that.
Let's talk about the tragedy of the commons and the nature of corporations and how they exist and how it's going to destroy the planet. Let's just set the Bilderberg Group and conspiracy to the side and just talk about human nature for a minute. Okay, now the tragedy of the commons says, okay, say you've got a village, and the guys in the village, what will happen? Continue.
Oh, well, we'll talk about the tragedy of the commons. We've got one short break to go. Our special guest is Matthew Stein, author of When Technology Fails at whentechfails.com and companyeastwardshow.com. We'll be right back.
Come gather around, people. Wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
To the Finney Eastwood Show with Will and our special guest who has been joining us on this lively debate today, Matthew Stein from whentechfails.com. Written the book, which I should probably recommend you get for the old survivalist aspects on it, at that website. Now, the tragedy of the commons, as I understand it, if you have basically a small village and everybody, you know, has to graze a goat or anything on a common ground and everything, it is in the best interest of one person to have extra goats, you know, just to benefit me and my family. So therefore, what happens is all the resources become stretched and scarce because everybody starts getting the same idea that they can have the most benefit by consuming the most amount of resources, when the reality is that there are limited amounts of resources on this planet, so therefore everything's going to collapse. Anyway, that's the tragedy of the commons.
Yeah, in a nutshell, that's, I've got to get it before the other guy because, you know, if I don't have that goat, somebody else will, and so I might as well because then my family can eat that goat meat and drink that goat milk and make goat cheese, and so it's like it's my right to have another goat, and the problem is that everybody thinks that way, and then you have overgrazing and the soil washes away and the goats starve and the people starve, and it ends up like that island, St. Matthew's Island, where all the reindeer ate everything in sight, and they went from 6,000 reindeer to 43 reindeer in a three-year period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you extend that to corporations, as a corporation, if I'm a head of a corporation, and my responsibility is to maximize profit for my stockholders, then what does that mean? That means that I go to that part of the world where there's no environmental controls, because if I'm operating in, say, the United States, and they force me to have environmental controls, and I'm paying lots of money to people who have, like, health care benefits, and they have high wages, then no, it's like I want to go to China, where there's no environmental controls, and I can pay slave wages to people. And then if I say, well, if I don't consume those resources faster and more efficiently, then somebody else is going to get those resources first. So as a corporate leader, then I must go in the part of the world where they pay slave wages, where they have no consideration for the environment, and where I can consume the maximum amount of resources for profit and gain as soon as possible. And what that is a recipe for consuming the natural systems that support life as we know it on planet Earth as fast as possible and as efficiently as possible to maximize profit before somebody else makes that profit before me. Because if I go slower, they'll get it first, and once it's gone, it's gone. So I better get there first.
I totally agree, but this is why I support free market as opposed to this sort of socialist system that the elite want to bring in.
But and the free market guarantees collapsing the world as fast and as efficiently as possible because there's no regulation to control it.
No, because the regulation comes from people. We don't have free market. You think that big government's good because you can stop all these evil corporations. The government is owned by corporations.
Okay,
so it's a total loss.
Because you've got lobbyists with their hands in the pockets of the Republicans and the Democrats equally. You've got 70
Republicans aren't
lobbyists for every single
market.
person in Congress.
But all I'm saying is a free market solution to the problem is that with fluid information sets and with educated people, which is, I know, talking out of the realm of possibility, that somehow you have people like, oh, that corporation's using slave labor in China. I'm not going to buy their goods. I'll support the company that has a moral code, uses an ethical code.
Yeah,
and so we'd hope that would occur. And then that person would be offset against by just natural competition, and they would be pushed out of the market. But instead, what we have, thanks to the socialist system, is China has a lower tariff than the United States. And the Congress changes regulation to give certain big corporations an unfair trade advantage over competition. And so what you've got is big government working in the favor of corporations, whereas you're saying they should be there to protect us. They never, ever will, because they're controlled by skull and bones and scumbags, elitist.
Well,
and this is the great deception, but continue.
Unfortunately, the control of corporations in our governments is probably going to guarantee the tragedy of the commons collapse of the world as we know it. Now, it is possible, and I have 12 points in my last chapter, Making the Shift to Sustainability, it is possible that people, that either the world will get slapped around so bad that we wake up before the collapse happens, or that people will wake up so much that they take control of the government back and they do the right thing. Now, without control, though, there's going to have to be control, but it's got to be control, like, not private industry control. I mean, it's something, I'm not saying I have all the solutions all worked out, but I will say that to implement the Plan B shift, Making the Shift to Sustainability in the world, costs less than the bailout of Wall Street costs. So we could have saved the world for less than we bailed out Wall Street. And obviously, we're much more concerned with bailing out Wall Street and keeping the status quo and keeping corporations going business as usual than we are with saving the planet. Now, my wife just brought up a point. She said, is it true that there was hundreds of whales that were recently beached in New Zealand? Is that something that really happened?
Yeah, it happens fairly regularly. Once every couple of years or so, we have a whole bunch of whales wash up. And incidentally, half decade or decade or so, we have big icebergs that float by our one of our main South Island cities, Dunedin, off the coast. So, you know, we have spectacular things that happened in interesting times. And there was another one where we had a glacial uprising. Now, this was interesting. A glacier actually grew. Yeah. A glacier actually popped up out of this big lake, a good 20 meters higher than it was the day previous. Amazing geological event. And, you know, there's amazing stuff that goes down. And I'd very much like to thank you, Matthew, for coming on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. And I'd love to have you back on again.
Well, it's a total pleasure. And I'd like to leave people with my motto before I sign off.
You have to be very quick.
I urge everyone, do your best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. And thank you so much for having me on your show, guys. It was really a pleasure.
I will give you a call in a moment for the Vinnie Eastwood Show podcast. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back tomorrow. Intel Hub up next.